4.2 million Americans have now been canceled by their insurance companies.
Canceled your show.
And Futurama's been canceled.
Canceled.
Canceled too soon.
Is officially canceled.
We canceled twice.
His launch pre-order bundle was canceled. Do we know it's a his?
Have been effectively canceled.
And abruptly canceled.
From Target is canceled.
Or unceremoniously canceled.
The plan was being canceled.
The cabal has been canceled.
Look at the role of the Rothschild family.
Money and power.
Monsanto and a few other chemical companies.
Culling the population through eugenics is their answer.
The World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Trade Organization.
These are the most disgusting people on the face of this earth.
Or they control the information.
The powerful few people who run this planet.
They're not as powerful as you think.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Now brings you Cancel the Cabal with Stephen Roberts. Stephen Roberts.
Red or blue?
And welcome everyone to another Friday night's People's Internet Radio's Cancel the Cabal. I'm Stephen Roberts, and as the intro mentioned, we are fighting a cabal of criminals. I want to thank Jill Trebilcock and Bill Murray for the show that they just did. I heard the better part of 40 minutes of it, but I didn't hear every single bit of it, but it was good that I did hear. I happened to mention to my guest who Bill Murray was. He didn't seem to know Bill, and I didn't know whether Bill knew of my guest, but I have David Schercher, and David is an author. He's also a survivor of the Franklin Affair in Nebraska. David's book is called The Rabbit Hole, a Satanic Ritual Abuse Survivor Story. So welcome back to the show once again, David.
Hey, thanks for having me, Stephen.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm going to put the Amazon link, and I'm going to put your website link in there also. Your website link is davidschurter.com, davidschurter.com. Anybody would like to check out his book. David is an interesting guy. He's got a harrowing story, of course. I know it's been like very, very close to a year since you've been on, David. Would you like to give a little revision of your life story?
Well, the last year has been pretty tumultuous. I got a divorce and moved away from the Midwest. My other half and I could not deal with the harassment that my family was giving me on a constant basis. And we could not handle he couldn't handle the death threats that were coming over the phone all the time. And the dead animals that were being left in our yard, and our cars were trashed. And it was a harrowing experience. And so I took off and came to the Pacific Northwest. And I live outside of Seattle now, and working on a new book about male abuse and how different it differentiates between males and females with a male perspective. And so I pretty much tried to get my life in order. It crumbled for a while. November, December were pretty hard months. I was in the throes of the divorce, and now I'm just kicking on. You know, I as I was telling you just before we started, Stephen, I met a lady out here. She's, and I become really close friends. She sells trees for a living. Well, she does other things for real work, but for her hobby, she sells trees, and convinced me today that I didn't have any trees in my yard, so I planted 15 trees. So my life has become kind of mundane. After everything I've gone through, that's kind of nice.
Yeah, mundane and boring can be nice sometimes.
Yes, it can.
David, Bill and Jill happened to be talking about his younger years also, him being molested by older men. If I remember his story right, at the age of 14 or 15, until he finally sought help in that. He happened to mention that he went into a rape center one time as a young man, and they threw him out because he was considered the enemy of what they were fighting as women being raped.
What you'll find is that there are not very many avenues for men, abuse survivors. We are, as male survivors, we're looked at as we're supposed to be strong. Abuse doesn't happen to us. And yet a lot of the abuse that I went through as a kid was all boys that were being molested. And there is this, my figures that I was just reading a book today, and it started talking about figures of a feminine male child, which we all know, you know, prepubescent boys can be feminine.
In appearance, you mean, yes?
In appearance, in appearance, and, you know, even in response time or responses and all of that, because the male psyche takes a while to develop. Well, those individuals are five times greater to be raped than females are. And so we're looking at a place where there's not a whole lot of help. Like you said, rape centers, rape trauma centers, all of that, they focus more on females than they do on males. There's not a whole lot of help for males. And that's one of the things that I'm talking about in my book, is how there needs to be a greater balance, because it's not just females who are being abused, it's men and women. And especially in the MK Ultra and males, because we have I've heard it talked about as the John Wayne syndrome, but we're all supposed to be, you know, butch and strong and tough as nails and all of that. But trauma and abuse affects a male in some ways greater than it does a female. Not saying that there is a competition or anything, because trauma is trauma, and anyone who's dealing with trauma goes through trauma. But because there is nowhere for a man to reach out to, and we're told to bottle our emotions and keep our emotions down and not talk about the problems that we have and not talk about the abuse that we've suffered, it doesn't allow a lot of avenues for healing for men. And so women can get into therapy and, dissociative identity disorder is primarily, most people believe, a woman type disease. I don't want to call it a disease, because it's not really a disease. It's more like a condition due to extreme abuse. But men basically get, like myself, have complex PTSD. And so there's just, you know, there's no way around getting through the abuse and reaching out to abuse. Most male groups, I've talked to a few people who have gone into male groups. I have not been in one myself, but I have talked to them, and their problem is that a lot of men don't identify with the abuse that that we as children went through, as far as the multiple rapes, the trauma of watching children being murdered, being abducted, people being hurt around us, you know, and that's just a gloss over of what the whole situation is. There's not a whole lot of places for us to go. And so that is really what my next book is focusing on, is that we need to have more of a rounded basis and realize that in Omaha, Nebraska, the same time that Omaha, Nebraska was having a problem with prostitution with boys, Houston, Texas was also having a problem with boy prostitution. And there is a video out. It interviews a man named Tom Philpott, who is a instructor. He is a professor. And after that happened, he supposedly committed suicide, even though I believe that he was onto stuff that was so much that he probably had a lot of help with that. But there, you can find that video both on my website and on YouTube. It's called Boys for Sale. And it talks about how prevalent and how easy it was to have boys prostitution. And that's a lot of, you know, a lot of people, I put in that it was a satanic ritual abuse survivor story, which it is. My family were definitely into satanic ritual abuse. But a lot of it was, when it's boiled down to it, and you take the satanic part out of it, it was child prostitution and prostitution of boys and child and boy trafficking. And so, and there's so many victims out there. And again, no place to go. Jump in anytime, Stephen. You know,
oh, yeah. Well, I can talk. I was just waiting for a good moment. I do want to mention last Friday, actually, I had on another author who has a very, very similar story to yours and Bill's. He's a survivor of child sexual abuse. His name is Robert Charles Hall. He wrote the book called Bobby's Socks. And what that tells is kind of a third person version of his life, but I'm not so sure if it's more nonfiction than fiction. I didn't get to ask him that, but there are a lot of correlations with his story and the boy in the book. But he's actually starting a foundation to where he will eventually, if starts to get enough support and enough money, he will try to have some type of a center for boys that are in need of spiritual help, mental help, or even physical, whatever the case happens to be. But I also wanted to mention, David, also that the first show that I had you on, it kind of opened up the floodgates for a lot of this stuff for me. Just many, many, many shows since the first time you were on, just bringing this subject up, along with just normal child abuse. And I also wondered, what in the world does the years 20, you know, in the 21st century, why is it finally coming out? Why didn't it really start to be prevalent in the 50s, 60s, or 70s, or 80s? Why is it coming out now so hard and heavy, do you think?
I think because we've reached a point in society where people are willing to talk. And not only that, but people are willing to listen. And abuse has become such a prevalent, we hear about child trafficking, we hear about childhood sexual abuse. You had a big, well, the False Memory Foundation was basically designed in 92 after all of the allegations were coming out about child abuse and especially satanic ritual abuse in the 80s, where you had McMartin and seven other preschools in the area where children were coming home with sexually transmitted diseases. And you had the Presidio, you had daycares in Atlanta. There were things going on in Michigan. And the False Memory Foundation came in and actually quelled that and made it to the point where therapists and people who were whistleblowers on the situation were in fear of being sued.
Made them look invalid.
And so it quieted everything down. It got to the point where you couldn't talk about anything. And but everything comes around in a circle. And so now we've reached a point where the FMSF has lost a lot of its power, a lot of its clout. You have situations like, you know, in the UK, Jimmy Savile, and all of the stuff that's starting to come out, the abuse that were down in Florida, where they're finding graves of children.
The White House boys. The White House boys, yeah.
Yeah, the White House boys.
I had three survivors on.
See all of this stuff come forward. And now people are starting to feel more energized to talk. And personally, I think that men are tired of being left out, and guys need healing as well. You know, if anything, it just ends up festering and you get angry and, you know, there's nothing around about it. And so I'm really grateful that there are people out there who are willing to write their stories, whether it be written as nonfiction or fiction, but to actually get the stories out there and get people thinking. I just commend everybody who does that. You know, it's just really important.
Well, I do too. I think it takes a lot of fortitude to look into your past and try to be able to deal with these horrors. Not a lot of people are able to. Some do take their lives, and some just keep it bottled up forever and ever.
It comes out in emotional ways.
Yes, it does.
Bottling it up only works for a certain point, and then it starts to come out. People start to lose sleep. They either gain a lot of weight or they lose a lot of weight. They start to have societal dysfunctions to where society, they can get angry, or panic attacks or fearful. It bottles up in a lot of ways, not to mention the bottling up the abuse and the emotions of the abuse also causes poor health. And so I think that I just think that we've reached a point in time where men are getting tired of being left out in the cold. This whole, suck it up, you're a man, you don't have any way. And I also believe that all of the wars that we've gone into and the young men and women who have come back severely traumatized has really woken up people to the whole psychology of post-traumatic stress disorder and getting people woken up to the fact that these conditions exist, and back to the False Memory Foundation, they would convince people that therapists are bad. They're all in it for the money. They're all in it for, it's all hogwash. There's nothing to it. But we're starting to realize that not only are we mental beings, that we have thought, but we are also emotional and spiritual. And you mentioned spiritual before, just a few minutes ago, and it is my contention that a strong faith in something higher than yourself, be it God, be it Jesus, be it Buddha, is fundamental to get through this type of situation, to try to understand that what happened to us, though it was atrocious, there are actual gifts to the whole situation. Not that it was a gift to actually be sexually molested or hurt or watched other people be hurt.
But maybe everything happens for a reason. Is that what you're trying to say?
Exactly.
Okay.
Everything happens for a reason. And I find that I'm 47 years old, and I have started to realize that the things that happened to me made me a very strong person. And not only did it make me very strong, but it also made me very aware. And that awareness I've been able to use that awareness to reach out to other people to help them become aware. And so it's not all folly, it's not all trauma and all of that. It pretty much is the perception of what you make of it. And, God has a hand in all of it. I spent many years angry. I called myself in the book an angry atheist because I was an atheist, not because I really didn't believe in God, but because I was so mad at God, I wanted to not deny God's existence. And I think that's true for a lot of survivors. But when you find out that maybe we went through what we went through for reasons beyond what we could see at the beginning, and as we get older, those things start to manifest in our lives, and we're able to help other people, you start to realize that maybe, because it's an undeniable fact that we all survived. Not all of us survived, but the people who are listening to this broadcast and have gone through trauma obviously survived. Most of us are still here, which shows the fortitude and the resilience of the human condition and the human spirit. And I think that is absolutely a wonderful thing once you start to focus on it. Now, 6 months ago, you could have asked me the same question, and I probably would have given you a completely different answer. But,
Well, I wasn't able to get a hold of you 6 months ago. and there were personal reasons for that, as you happened to mention in the beginning. You were going through personal strife and personal things, and we had a show scheduled, but it didn't happen that night. So anyways, we are on to bigger and better things. It is great. It is great that you've found some type of an avenue to try to heal spiritually. I think spirit is much more prevalent to be healed than some type of a physical wound. Skin and bone heals, and scars kind of fade away after time, but you know, the emotional scars don't. For some people. But hopefully you're on a better path now. Do you think you are?
Oh yeah, I do. One of the things that happened, which has surprised many people, is that I allowed myself to study with and become baptized in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And talk a lot about, I'm actually a ward missionary in my district, and I love the church that I'm at. The people are incredibly gracious. If anybody wants to study a little bit more, they can always go to mormon.org. Yes, it is a Mormon church. It surprises a lot of people that I went and decided to join the Mormon church, but I really do find that the fact that they are so community and family oriented, it's just something that actually really made me aspire to be more than what I was at the time. And I will tell you that I would not have made it this last year, this last 6 months especially, without the help of church members coming and being there for myself, being there for me. And the biggest thing that we do when we go through this type of abuse is we isolate. We isolate and we become very antisocial. I mean, I wouldn't say antisocial in a bad way, but it's hard to reach out.
Maybe more hesitant to be social.
Right. Yeah. We become much more hesitant. And the church actually helped me out a lot. I had a lot of, with many people, I had a lot of misconceptions about the church. I brought those to the missionaries. Not only did I brought those to the missionaries, but I brought them to the bishop. There is, on Mormon.org, there's a grouping that says why I'm a Mormon. And I'm getting ready to actually film a video for myself and talk about why I actually became baptized as a Mormon. I know it has there's a lot of hesitancy to people. There's a lot of, you know, stuff that people think, oh golly, you know, and I can't say honestly that I adhere to every single thing that the Mormon Church, believes, but, enough of it to where it's really helped me and changed my life. But I always tell people that if that doesn't make you, if that makes you uncomfortable, there's all kinds of avenues. You know, it's all a process. Healing is a process, and it all takes time. And actually starting to realize that there's something bigger and stronger than each of us, and believing that it's very caring, it's a caring entity, is very important to healing. To realize that we're not alone, and that what we went through was not for naught. You know, it wasn't useless. It wasn't just abuse for abuse sake. There, you know, you can use what happened to us and transform not only our own individual lives, but we can use the gifts that we were given through that abuse to help transform other people's lives. And it has been my experience that because of the abuse that I went through, I'm able to identify the abuse when I see it in other people. And it allows me to not only identify it, but it compels me to reach out to those people. And I've helped change more than one life, you know, and that's not I'm so great or anything like that. It's just that's what we're here for. That's personally what I believe we're here for.
Yes, me too.
Yeah. Help each other. You know.
Since that first show with you, David, I've had, I don't know, countless people, maybe even close to 100. Tell me thank you a lot for getting this out there on the internet. I know this isn't an FM or an AM station or anything like that, but the word is getting out there. And some of these pedophile rings have actually come down in the last couple of years now. the one up there in Toronto. I think there was one out there in New York that got brought down. They are diligently, as you happen to mention, down there in Florida, Dozier, Florida. They're working on digging up bodies. The last I heard, they had at least 55, and they were going to look for more. This was a boys' home that actually was built in 1900 or 1901, and I think it finally got shut down in 2011. So it ran for like 110 years. I get countless people every single week thanking me for bringing this stuff out. I imagine you do too, don't you?
I do. I get emails. It's hard for me to keep up on my emails, actually, because I get a lot of people who usually don't want anything other than to commiserate and say how they were part of the same kind of situation and that they're happy that I was strong enough to come forward and talk about the situation. And much like what you're saying is that, you know, and that's what it is, Stephen, is that it's really, we have the opportunity to inspire other people if we allow ourselves to inspire other people. And that's really, you know, I get asked all the time, what do I want to be when I grow up? And my whole reply always is that I want to be an inspiration. I want to inspire people to be better than what they are right now. And as I inspire them, I want to allow myself to be able to be inspired by them to compel me to be a better person. And it's all a spiritual type situation. And I mean, people such as yourself who are out there actually talking about the real issues and being honest about it and not having a lot of hoopla, or, you know, you're pretty much down to earth. And I think that's what people want, is that they want to hear people who are down to earth talk about these situations in a real life context of what it is and how it affects people. And you do a marvelous job at that. You know, I watch what you do online and the people that you have. So I could see why people would come and say, you know, thank you to you. I'm one of those people. I'm very grateful. You know, I'm very grateful for being on your show, and I'm grateful for the things that you do that you make me aware of.
Well, you're welcome. There is a question from the chat. Maybe some more will come in, but did you ever turn to a drink or drugs or anything like that? Or
I was a marijuana smoker for quite some time. I did it to medicate myself. I did it for, you know, I used marijuana to escape boredom. I was never much of a drinker. My mother was an alcoholic, and so alcohol kind of turned me off. But I did get into, and when I was a younger man, a teenager, I had some friends who got me into, who were trying to get me into other kinds of drugs. And so I've tried a lot of drugs, but nothing ever really stuck. I was I guess what you'd call a pothead until last November. And when the divorce happened with the breakup, I decided that I wanted a whole new lifestyle. And so I gave that up. Now, I have nothing bad to say about people who use marijuana for medicinal reasons. And I really, you know, I, to be quite honest, prefer pot over alcohol. However, for me, it was not a good situation. I was using it in a completely bad way for myself. And so that's why I quit. And now joining the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, they have what is called the Words of Wisdom. And it's things that they want you to refrain from doing. Drugs are one of those, obviously. Sex out of marriage is one of those things. And I'm not dating. I'm not doing anything. So just kind of enjoying being by myself and being with my friends. The Words of Wisdom also talk about no coffee or caffeine. It's basically no addictions. They want you to stay away from addictions as much as you can. And so I basically refrain from drinking iced tea or coffee because of the caffeine, even though they allow you to drink Coca-Cola. and I drink lots of that. You know, I drink a good couple glasses a
well,
day.
Well, that's got plenty of sugar and caffeine in it there, right there.
Yeah, it has caffeine in it. But I pretty much tried to, you know, it's I was asked one time why I wanted to be baptized in the church. And I basically explained, what is one life to give to God? You know, and I know that sounds trite, or it could sound trite, but really when it comes down to it, I just want to focus my life as much as I can on God and doing the right thing. And so I changed. I got a divorce, and I'm no longer, I mean, as people will read in my book, I basically led a gay lifestyle. And I have refrained from all of that because of my spiritual beliefs. I am not a self-loathing homosexual. I identify myself as being gay. I just don't want to lead the gay lifestyle. And so I basically have turned my life over to the church, and I spend a lot of time trying to help people. As a ward missionary, I try to help people in my community. I've been taking people to food banks. I go help them mow their lawns if they're, you know. Tonight, after the interview, I'm going over to a retired couple's house. They need a room in their basement painted, so I'm going to go paint their basement. You know, you just basically give your life to other people. And I always tell people, if you're feeling bad about yourself and you're feeling bad about your life and you want to make yourself feel better, then go out your front door and find someone who has it worse than you and help them. And I swear it will make you feel so much better about yourself when you're helping another person. And so, you know, it seems like an easy solution, but it really does work.
Yes, it absolutely does. I know that for a fact myself. Not just this internet radio stuff here, David, but in my personal life, too. I remember back in 2008, long before I even dreamt of going back into college or doing this internet radio stuff, I didn't even have a computer. But in 2007 and 2008, I was taking care of my dad at the end of his life. He did finally die in August of 2009. I'm sorry, 2008. But I would take him to his dialysis clinic three days a week. And while I was there, I would help others that were in the same type of situation. I would open up doors for them, get wheelchairs for people that needed them, held on to some older people's hands and walked them back to their chairs. Made me feel good. I always got a kiss from the older women and handshake from the men, and got told
thank you. You and I have a lot in common in what you just said, because yeah. I did the same thing for my mother. She was on dialysis three times a week.
Yeah.
And there's nothing like taking care of a parent. And for those who are out there whose parents let them down as kids, let me tell you, if you have the opportunity to help them
and
as
he
adults.
Did. He did help. He did let me down, too, big time.
Yeah. My mother changed my world. She did. I was able to make amends with both my parents before their prospective deaths, which helped me a lot as far as my healing, my own healing goes. And being a very caring individual, Stephen, that takes work. You know, it's easier to look the other way and ignore people's problems than it is to actually go and confront them and help them walk to their chairs and all of that. So you're just a good guy all the way around. You know?
yeah, that's what a lot of people tell me. But seems the good guys finish last here. I don't know. Maybe I won't finish last.
Well, the reason why good guys finish last is because we're helping everybody else get across the finish
line. Is that what the deal is? Okay.
That's what, you know, you're the kind of person who, if someone falters and falls down, you're stopping and turn around and going back and helping them up to get them across the finish line. You know, that's why good guys always finish last, because we're the ones. But in the Bible, doesn't it say that those who come first in the end will come last? those who are high will be brought down low. And, you know, not to quote scripture
it does say that. And hopefully the ones that are taking advantage of all the people, the children and just the taking advantage of everybody just in life in general. You know, I don't wish ill on them, but I wish they would be brought down a notch or two. I know that last statistic I heard, David, there are, I think, nearly 700,000 sexual abusers on the sexual abusers list. That means there are 700,000 people that have been convicted of some kind of sexual abuse. What do you think? What type of a solution do you think there should be to bring them numbers down?
Well, personally, I think we need to stop glorifying youth. We need to stop, you know, if you want to stop and really know how to curb it, the first thing to do is to turn off the television. Because the television actually is really promoting this type of behavior. I explain to people a lot of times that the in society, the very top of the list of inventions that changed society was the Gutenberg press. And the Gutenberg press, what it did was, for those of people who don't know what the Gutenberg press is, it was the first printing machine, and it actually put the written word onto paper, and so it made it widely distributed. Before we had the Gutenberg press, we had a glorification of youth. We had a high incidence of adults having sex with children. And we had a large percentage of people who were viewing children as young adults. They are not young adults. You do not have the capacity to actually, your brain isn't completely formed as an adult until you're in your 20s. You know, that's how long it takes. And so television, basically, what ended up with the Gutenberg press is that it divided information, and it took and it started to dispel information to certain age groups. And so and it brought along the educational system. Television has decimated that. It has turned our children know more about the world than their parents do most of the time now. You know, as far as computers go, children know more about computers than their parents do. And as we see it, what we have is, if you watch television and you watch sitcoms, what do they do with children? They make children into little adults. They have witty comments. You know, the parents are generally going to the kids asking them for questions.
Yes, yes. And the male figure in the show is acting like a 7-year-old.
Right, right. And that's, what we're seeing is that the media and there is a lot of speculation that the media is being run by Satanists, that it is to, you know, bringing down society. I don't know if all those people are Satanists. I know what I know, what I grew up with, and I knew that Satanists existed where I went. I don't know the whole scope of everything, for sure. I have a good idea. But I will say that society is being brought down by our media. It's, you know, I just watched a video on Facebook. Someone shared this video on Facebook, and it was these preschool-age children, and they were teaching them how to dirty dance. It was the most horrifying, disgusting video I had ever seen in my entire life. And I've seen, you know, I've had several things brought to my attention, but it rates right up there with being the most disgusting. They were bumping and grinding and it was weird to watch all of these preschool age kids, and they were dancing with adults, and, you know, it was, and they were being encouraged, and they were being, you know, basically what ends up happening is that I don't like to get on a soapbox, and I don't like to preach morality, but when it comes down to it, society better get a hold of what this downfall that we're experiencing, or we're going to go into some very, very dark days.
Well, yes, it is. It's been a proven fact up until like 50 plus years ago, maybe even 60 years ago, the black communities, black families, they had 10% divorce rates. They had only 10% illegitimacy rates. The man and the woman stayed together more than white people did back in the 60s. Then the sexual revolution hit, and the anarchism industry, more or less, came about also. The Black Panthers, the Nation of Islam. I'm not saying that either of these two factions or groups caused the rates that are happening now. Over 7 out of 10 black children don't have a father in their home. Over 7 out of 10 are illegitimate also. But there is something that happened back then, started attacking the black people of America. Things started changing. And they changed for the worse.
Not so much. I mean, I would take it away from racism and put it more of a classism.
Sure.
Because that's what you're experiencing with poor people. And what you have is that you have a group that's been kept down. And, you know, and it's interesting that, you know, basically my sister is a social worker. She graduated top of her class with both her master's and her bachelor's. And she says that unless you're very lucky, the social status that you are born with is the one you will end up dying with. You know, as much as all of us would like to think that we are impoverished millionaires, for the most part, most of us who are middle class will either stay middle class or become poor. And it's what we're seeing is that there's a real focus now away from family, because families have kind of basically deteriorated. Our government has really pushed this whole situation to actually bring down the families.
Bring down the family, yes.
Well, and it's interesting that you talk about black families in the 60s, because in the 60s and 70s and 80s, when I was a kid growing up, I wanted to be black so bad, because I did not have a good family. And I did identify with the black communities as being very strong as far as families go. And now it's so inundated. The poor areas of town, which are not just white, they're not just black, not just white, not just Latino. It's a whole collection of everybody who's poor. And it's so drug ridden and chaotic that the education level, you know, it's the education. Not only is spirituality and a sense of strong or important for a sense of morality, but to actually be focused and be an adult who is well-rounded, education is a major factor. And we have done everything we can, especially, you know, it wasn't starting, but it was exemplified by No Child Left Behind, which, I knew some teachers who used to call it No Teacher Left Standing. But we've done everything we could to decimate the educational levels of society. And so now you have a lot of people who, you know, perfect example is that they were saying how tests in schools were they were a little bit more racist than most people suggested, because it would talk about walking to the grocery store in your neighborhood. Well, some neighborhoods don't have grocery stores. You have to take 3 buses to get to a grocery store, you know, or there's a little convenience store, but it's so overly priced. And so you really have a sense of educational, an imbalance of education. And it really does factor in that poverty levels. You know, in Omaha, Nebraska, and then I'll get off my soapbox, but in Omaha, Nebraska, they had Westside High School, which was the rich elite area, and every single senior got a laptop computer. In North Omaha, which is where primarily the blacks and the Latinos, well, pretty much the blacks, South Omaha was Latinos, but the black community was in there, they had 30 computers total.
Are you talking about just recently? Are you talking about just recently here?
Just recently.
Okay.
They just talked about that just recently. And so that's what you're having, is that you're having this lack of education, this lack of, you know, when you have people who are being kept down and they are given no opportunities to advance themselves, there's no incentive for them to do better than what they do already. And that transcends all race, you know, all races. If you keep people down, they will have a tendency to exemplify that because they can't get ahead. And so when you have a society that's kept down, they lose hope. They lose family structure. They lose, you know, it's a bad situation. And so, now it's transcending to where they have us fighting, but let me assure people that it's not the black family or the white family or the Latino family or the Chinese family or the Korean family or the Muslim family that live down the street that's causing the problems. The problems are being caused by Congress and our politicians and the people who run things. That's what's causing the issues. That's what's causing the disparity. And really what comes, you know, my sister talks about having a revolution all the time, that there's going to be a revolution. And the more we watch what's going on, the more I wonder, you know, if that's not going to be the case, that we're going to have a revolution and we're going to have to take the land away from the rich corporations and the politicians and put it back into the hands of the people. Sorry, I'm kind of all over the place. But
no, that's okay. I wanted to go ahead and let you finish up here, and then I thought we'd take a break. We're nearly at the hour here, and I could use a quick break here myself. So are you ready for a break?
Cool. Yeah, it's, you know, it's really what I would like to see happen is that we bond more with communities.
Yes, absolutely.
And that the black community will stop fighting for black rights and start fighting for Muslim rights and women rights.
Human rights.
And women fight for black rights and for Latino rights and white people. You know, if we all started fighting for the rights of everyone else instead of just for ourselves and for everyone else, I think we would see a lot more achievement in the world.
Yes, we would. And we'll go ahead and take that break, everyone, here. I got about 5 minutes set up here, so we will be right back. All right, and welcome back, everyone. We're still continuing on. I'm still Stephen Robertson. I still have David Schroeder with me. I thought maybe, you know, we have virtually a brand new network, David, since the first two times that you were on. It's a growing network. I know for a fact we've got anywhere between, I think, 400 to 500 new listeners that have joined the network just this year alone. I wondered if you might want to talk about Rabbit Hole and talk about your life a little bit.
Sure. I wrote Rabbit Hole 2.5 years ago, or I got it published 2.5 years ago. I wrote it. It took me a few months to write it. It was about my childhood experiences as far as my family being Satanists and child traffickers. And I didn't write it to publish it. I actually wrote it because I had spent most of my life telling myself that I was crazy for what I believed and the things that I remembered. And so I decided to sit down and write it all out so I could see it for myself in black and white. And it talks about, I talk a little bit about my childhood and a little bit about the satanic stuff. What a big portion of the book is about is my relationship with people who are involved with a failed savings and loan called Franklin Credit Union in Omaha, Nebraska, and the child trafficking and drugs and guns that were being trafficked all around. I talk a bit about my experiences as an MKUltra survivor. Offutt Air Force Base was involved in the abuse that I went through. For those people who are interested in reading the book, the edited version is on Amazon, but I just recently put the unedited version, the first book that I actually wrote, I put it on my website, davidschroeder.com, so that people could see it. It gave a little bit more, well, just to give people an idea, my book that I wrote was close to 100,000 words, and the edited version with everything that was taken out and the stuff that they added for the book was 64,000 words. And so there's quite a bit more involved in the whole situation.
What does that mean in pages?
Well, it's a little under 200 pages in the book, the actual published book. And in the book that the book that I actually wrote, it was a little over 300 pages. So it's a good 100 pages added. There's a lot more to it. I tell people, even if you've read Rabbit Hole, I was lucky enough to actually be nominated for Best Book of the Year by a publisher for people who did vanity publishing, such as myself. But I just put the unedited version on there. So it talks a little bit more about my spirituality. It talks a little bit more about the fundamental problems that I was having with the investigations that were going on. The satanic stuff, it talks a little bit more about the satanic stuff. There's a couple chapters in there in the unedited version. I talk about when I was attacked and I thought it was a case of road rage. The guy came out of nowhere and tried to break my neck. And now I think that my sisters always believed that it was an assassination attempt. And there's also there's a chapter in there where I called the Democratic headquarters in Nebraska the day that Obama came to Omaha as he was running for president his first time. And talk about all of that and the fact that they ended up calling Omaha Obamaha for the day. And which is really kind of disgusting when you consider how Republican Nebraska and Omaha is as a whole. And so it talks a lot about stuff, you know, and people say, oh, well, you know, you couldn't have gotten that close to Obama. Well, yes, I did get that close to Obama. They campaigned. In fact, when Mitt Romney was running against Obama this last time, I so much shook his hand and had a conversation with Mitt Romney because they all campaigned in Omaha and Council Bluffs.
Omaha's the Kickstarter for the campaigns.
That's exactly it. It's a Kickstarter.
And it's really funny about Obama. You happen to mention him and the Democrats or whatever, but he's actually the best Republican that any party could ever wish to have. He's out warmongered Bush bigger than Bush ever dreamed of.
Go ahead. Oh yeah. It's funny because I was not the time that I met with him, or I was trying to get a hold of him to help me with Omaha and all of that. I stopped being an Obama fan. And if you remember right, the first election with Obama, if anybody came out and said that they didn't like Obama, you were immediately labeled a racist. You know, oh, you're a racist. You don't like black people. That's why you don't like Obama.
They're still doing that today, though.
They're still doing it today, but there's a lot more people who are actually against Obama now. You know, it's the political system is broken. All we get are sociopaths. That's all we ever get for elections.
Yes, it is.
You know, it's...
Say, David.
Yeah.
Would you like me to bring in a friend? She's actually a show host also, and she can add a lot to the subject matter here.
Oh, sure.
Okay. I'm going to give her a message and tell her to turn the radio down or off. But go ahead and continue there for a minute.
Yeah. I don't feel much... You know, I think that... I'm not the only one who feels disenfranchised from our government and that, you know, feels that our government is running for our big corporations and for the money. And I basically, in my book, in the extended version, you know, and on my blog, because I wrote about Obama after that on my blog, and basically my quote was, a sellout is a sellout is a sellout. You know, you can look at it any way you want, but... You sell out, you're a sellout, you know? And that's basically, I have a lot of irritation from the first presidency because there was a lot of hope and change that was pushed along with all of this whole situation. And
whoops. Wrong one. I got to call her. What is it? Ah, there it is. Okay. It shouldn't ring now.
Okay.
Hello. I rang your home phone earlier, and it was still stuck on your home phone.
Oh, you didn't know what was going on.
Hi, Jill. Hi, David. Welcome.
Hi, Steven. Hey, how are you?
This is Jill.
Yeah, thanks.
You have some questions for David? I've got plenty of questions, but I thought maybe you might like to add to the subject.
Oh, David. So you wrote the amazing Down the Rabbit Hole book, right?
Right.
Yeah, and that's pretty amazing. And I haven't read the book, but I have heard an interview of yours before. And in fact, I remember hearing Stephen at the beginning of this interview saying how it really changed his life and you know, brought us sort of into this world. And I thought you were mad at the time. I mean, I didn't think you were really completely mad. I just thought all these people in Satanism and stuff. Anyway, it's my new catch cry, Satanism at the moment. I'm hearing it everywhere, and it seems to be everywhere, and it's far more prevalent than I thought, and I'm very disappointed with the world.
Oh, yeah.
I can't believe there's so much Satanism around.
Well, you know, as far as I was thinking about it when we were on the break, and with Satanism they had a satanic rally down in Florida for Rick Scott. And now they're getting ready to erect a statue of Baphomet with two children lovingly looking up at him in Oklahoma City, right next to the Ten Commandments.
Well, how about
and
that?
The fact that there's, oh yeah, oh yeah.
David, how about
you
that?
You can Google it and find it.
Yeah, how about that? How about that statue in the Vatican that they just put up last year or whatever it's been in the last couple of years?
Well, and that's just it. Another example is that in the UK with Jimmy Savile and the connections that he had. And my whole thing is that you just had a year or two before, well, maybe a little bit longer before Jimmy Savile died, you had Rupert Murdoch who was busted for basically eavesdropping on every single person in the UK that he could. And so you're telling me that Rupert Murdoch and the people associated with it didn't know what was going on with Jimmy Savile. And I agree. I'm pretty much disheartened with society because there's not more of an outcry with all of this situation. You know, people are still looking at it as, oh, well, this is just crazy, or it doesn't involve me, or, you know, it involves all of us. And there are children who are being hurt in this whole situation. And I know it sounds crazy. I mean, people who are just starting to listen to it and actually hear a little bit more about it, at the very beginning, it just sounds so off the wall. But when you start to look at the situations, it's really a very disheartening situation because there's so many people who could do something. And society really does need to stand up. We need to start fighting for our own rights again, you know, to protect children.
Well, let's hear your story. Like, the thing that had me interested was you were saying that you started having dreams and then you realized that the dreams may not be false memories. And you were talking about false memories earlier in the show. Do you want to tell about that direct experience?
You know, with my stuff, I never really necessarily forgot. The thing that what ended up happening was that I started to, when you go through trauma, such as I did, you actually close things down and you spend a lot of time telling yourself it never happened. It never happened. It never happened. I spent a lot of time, a lot of years telling myself it never happened. Mm-hmm. And as we were talking at the beginning, you know, you start to go and you deny that for so long and it starts to come out in other ways. And so it was affecting my dreams. It was affecting my sleep patterns. I was waking up traumatized at night. My sister said my sister actually has dissociative identity disorder from the abuse. I did not get dissociative identity disorder, but she spent a lot of time waking up at the foot of the stairs, you know, panicked at the foot of the stairs, wanting to jump down the stairs. And so it was basically, that's why I wrote Rabbit Hole, because I started to figure out all the stuff that I remembered, all it, you know, all of the stuff that I told myself I was crazy about. I wanted to actually write down on paper to see what it looked like, to see how crazy it was.
Yeah.
And what it ended up doing is, you know, it basically solidified my memories, and I started realizing that what I remembered was not only not crazy, and not only was it, it was actually more realistic than what I thought it would be. And so that's why I started doing what I did. But then I also had my father, who came out right before he died, telling people that he had committed crimes against kids and was coming clean about his crimes.
So he was part of that ring, was he, David?
Oh, yeah, yeah. My sister, at his funeral, his hospice nurse came and talked to my sister. And I told my sister that what we wanted to do was go into the daily notes of his hospice nurse, because he was detailing all of the crimes against kids. But we can't get to it because my stepmother had the records sealed. And so nobody can read them without her permission.
Yeah. I've been told by others, David, that somebody who is high up in the, you know, the Masons or other elite groups, it is a very, very high honor for them to sacrifice a child to the Satanistic groups. Do you think, well, I asked another former guest who was abused. She ended up being a federal judge for many, many years, but she's retired now. Do you think you might have been chosen to be sacrificed, but you broke free of it and made your way out of the home?
I was, from what I've gathered from my recollections, and I was lucky enough to have older siblings who were involved with it, who were the youngest of my oldest siblings is 12 years older than I am, and my oldest sister Cindy was 16 years older than I was. And so I was able to go not only to have my memories, but to actually, they remembered a lot of stuff that I didn't. And I was meant to, at the very beginning, I was meant to take my father's place. And so I was involved with slaughtering kids with my dad when I was a child.
That is an amazing sentence, David. And I remember you saying that before. And I want to grab you right there. Thanks, Stephen, for letting me in here. Can you just repeat that and tell us about that? Like, that is, and the fact that you can talk about this publicly, it's all just so extraordinary, and I really want to know more.
Oh, David, I forgot to tell you, Jill is a degreed sociologist.
Oh. It doesn't matter.
My sister's involved, but the sacrifice, my father wore, the symbol for the sacrifice that we dealt with was red robes, which dealt with blood sacrifice. And from what I have, what I was taught as a child and what I learned as an adult and have basically put together is that what happens is that when you get a child and you bring them to the moment of fear and pain, to the crescendo of fear and pain, which they focused on boys. I don't remember any girls being sacrificed. Now, my sister says that she remembers girls being sacrificed, but I don't remember any girls. They were always boys, and they were always prepubescent boys. And you would basically slice and dice them. I mean, you would cut them, you know, skin cuts out part of their skin, you know, do anything you could to cause them severe amounts of pain.
Right, so sort of skin them alive. While they're alive, you lift their skin.
Right, right. And would eat pieces.
You saw that.
Because cannibalism was a big part of it.
Why?
And what ends up happening with blood sacrifice is that when you bring it to the crescendo, the blood in the victim has so many endorphins running through it that blood sacrifice would happen. We would end up drinking the blood afterwards, and immediately afterwards, an orgy would happen. And I would end up getting raped, basically. And so, because the blood acts like an aphrodisiac with all of the endorphins in it.
Yeah. Okay, so I was wondering what was so good about the blood, and I was thinking, like, one of the reasons they must want children's blood is because it has younger cells in it that would actually cause some sort of youthing too, and they must have discovered that. I know science has discovered that now.
Yeah, it's, and they basically focused on young boys, I think, because of the story of Abraham. In the Bible, that's what I've ascertained. I've never been told that, but that's kind of what I've ascertained. But it was always children that they actually did it to, and it was because children were God's favorite. Now,
hey, let's go about it this way. I want to let's take you back, if you don't mind. What did you think when you saw those other children? I mean, what was it like for you? Like, how young were you first introduced to these rituals? And then, see, the thought that's on my mind is, right, so you actually knew you weren't going to be killed, and yet you had to come along and watch all these children being killed, and you were actually just sort of conditioned to this. This was normality to you because this is the way they reared you. Can you just take us into that situation a little bit, please, David? Would you mind?
Oh, no, go. Sure.
You don't have to sugarcoat it. Don't sugarcoat it.
Well, I was brought into it from the very beginning. My mother went into labor with me on Thanksgiving night, and because the date of my birth was so important, they prolonged the pregnancy until the 6th of December. And so that's quite that's a long labor.
That's like an extra 5 weeks, isn't it?
It was. She started having labor pains on Thanksgiving night. She never let me forget it. It was something that I went through. And when I was born, I was breech with my hands up like this. And so I must have been trying to keep myself from being born. I don't know. But I was born at 6 o'clock or 6:03 in the morning at December 6, 1966, because the three sixes were important. I was being raised as a child to believe that I was the Antichrist. Now, you never knew. Growing up, you spent I spent an inordinate amount of time afraid, because you didn't know if you were going to end up dead. You didn't know if you were going to end up making them angry. You know, the beatings and emotional, a good example is that my father would wake me up in the middle of the night, beat me, become so aroused at beating me that it would end up being a rape. And so the satanic step that we went through is kind of the same way, is that even though I wasn't being killed, on they had this ritual table that was basically, they could transport it. You could pick it up. It wasn't always there. Hummel Park was where we did most of the killings. And I asked my sister just pretty much 6 months ago if she remembered how many deaths that she experienced as a kid. And she told me she has no idea how many, and I don't either, because you could have a night where they murdered three kids and three boys. And people say, you know, well, where do the kids come from? Well, in the early 90s, the Missing and Exploited Center for Missing and Exploited Children say that 2,185 kids are being reported missing daily. And back in the 60s and 70s, when we were kids, there was anyone could disappear. There was no computers. There was no tracking. There was none of that. And so,
David, what was it like? What was it like? You wouldn't even remember the first time that you were sexually penetrated then, would you?
No. It happened at such an early age. The sad part about it is that it's like what my sister and I talked about, is that killings and murdering people and murdering kids and experiencing all that was so commonplace to us that it was, you know, it didn't affect us. Like, you know, when you grow up as a child and it's the only thing that you know, and it's been going on and on and on, you don't know the distinction. You don't know the difference between what is going on and what's not. And there were so many drugs used. They were using mescaline back when to just basically drug the kids. You know, a lot of times when I was going through the abuse and I was going through the killings of kids, I was so drugged out that it was hard to differentiate what was real and what was not, which was, you know, common for a lot of people. The thing that actually saved me is that when I was 12 years old, a guy came, one of my playmates had disappeared. She lived a few blocks down when we lived in Omaha, Nebraska. And her dad showed up at our house in Fremont, Nebraska. And my stepmother drugged his iced tea. They drugged him, drug him downstairs. That night, they ended up having me light him on fire. My father doused him with charcoal fluid, and my stepmother handed me a match, and I ended up having to throw a match on the guy, which obviously woke him up, lighting him on fire. He was screaming, and my dad took a shovel and shoved it into his stomach, and then I was told to go upstairs. But that wasn't part of any of my training, and I ended up having a psychotic break from it. I wasn't drugged. I was stone cold sober when it happened. I have a video out there on my website called I Need Help Solving a Murder, and where I actually go to the house, and you can hear why no one heard the guy screaming is because the trains are so loud in the background that it was just completely And so that was the breaking point for me. That's what got me out of the situation.
David, I just thought of something. I've seen the videos of the ritualistic snuff films. Did you ever see anything like that, where they would take a victim, male or female, and just ritualistically dismember them with a chainsaw or hatchets or anything like that? Or
in Omaha, Nebraska, the snuff films were being actually filmed at a place called the Hollywood Bar. And the Hollywood Bar was across the street and down the road, just like maybe half a block from the Omaha police station, the main police station. When the reports got out that there were snuff films being filmed there, they ended up tearing down and building up a parking garage. Nobody looked into any of the allegations. They just kind of just bypassed it and tore the place down and built up a...
Now that's kind of insinuating that the police and local officials knew about it then, right?
Oh, Robert Wadman, who was chief of police, knew exactly what was going on. My brother was, if you look into the Franklin Credit Union, my brother was the second photographer. Rusty Nelson talks about there were two photographers that looked alike. And my brother looked like Rusty Nelson, that scruffy beard and long hair and just, kind of looking gruff. And my brother was actually the second photographer, and I knew that because he had a dark room in Fremont that had a bunch of child porn that I was never allowed in his bathroom because he had so much child porn in there. When he died in Ocean City, Maryland, 2 years later, a man named Larry King Jr., not the same Larry King who was involved with the Franklin Savings and Loan, but a different Larry King in Ocean City, Maryland, got busted with satanic ritual abuse or satanic ritualistic porn of children in Ocean City, Maryland, 2 years later. And I believe that is my brother's. Those were my trophy. That's what my brother's trophy pictures were.
His collection.
And so, I talk a lot about. I just got done talking about on my website. I have a. What I've been trying to do with my website. And I talk about the child trafficking and people such as Johnny Gosch and the two other paper boys that disappeared from West Des Moines and Jacob Wetterling, who disappeared from Minnesota, and Ricky Chaddick, who disappeared in Omaha, Nebraska. All of these, what links all of these abductions is that there were three cars involved. A white Oldsmobile, a big blue utility truck, and a station wagon with wood paneling around it. My family owned all three of these. And so I believe that my father was one of the people who was abducting these kids. Jacob Wetterling, my siblings lived in Minnesota at the time around the area. Johnny Gosch and the two other boys, they lived in, that happened in West Des Moines. My aunt lived there. And we were from Omaha, Nebraska. And so Ricky Chaddick was, taken from there as well. And so I believe that my parents were involved in this child abduction ring. Ricky Chaddick also vacationed at the same lake that we did in Minnesota called Silver Lake. And when you consider the fact that Minnesota is known for 10,000 lakes, it's pretty big coincidence that he vacationed on the same lake that we did. And he ended up disappearing, knowing what my family was involved with.
Now,
I actually...
Go ahead. Well, I was just struggling to remember because I've seen that documentary twice about the Franklin cover-up, but it's been more than a year ago now that I've seen it. But did you know any of the well, I think there was like two boys. They were young men at the time, and when they made the documentary in their 20s or whatever. But did you happen to know them two boys or anything? Or
I never knew Paul Bonacci. I personally don't trust Paul Bonacci. I knew Troy Bonner very well.
Troy Bonner was a bear boy. Okay.
And Troy Bonner was a pathological liar. We didn't get along very well at all.
Was he?
I tell people, and this is what I actually wrote on my website, was that the False Memory Foundation wants to say that everyone who claims satanic ritual abuse has DID. And it came from bad therapists. Well, Paul Bonacci was the very first court case ever that equated SRA, which is satanic ritual abuse, with DID. And it was his DID experiences that got the grand jury to actually dismiss everything. And what I think happened is that the powers that be sent Paul Bonacci and Troy Bonner to Alicia Owen. Alicia Owen was a underage girl who was claiming that Robert Wadman, who was chief of police at the time, was father of her baby. And she was the real victim of the whole situation and could have brought this all to a head. But they made it out to be such a folly and such a joke with the help of Harold Anderson, who ran the Omaha World Herald, which was the newspaper and where all the news was coming from at the time. And so it was basically, you know, the rich and powerful got off the whole situation.
Yes, they have. The documentary in the end, it happened to mention some multimillionaire that's lives in that area there. He, I think the ring had taken place in most of his facilities, hadn't they? And then he mysteriously had.
It was happening. Alan Bear owned.
That's Brandeis. The name. Yes, that's the name.
And it was and a lot of it was happening at Brandeis, and it was going down in the old market. Peter Citrin, who they talk about, who actually got busted for it, was my mother's co-worker at the Sun Times. They didn't talk about Dick Bishop, but Dick Bishop was heavily involved. He was involved with not only my mother, who was his business partner, but he was a Hell's Angel, an unofficial Hell's Angels, because they were trafficking young boys and drugs out of his house. And so all of this stuff, and it was connected with Offutt Air Force Base, who was bringing in cocaine at the time. You know, everyone remembers the Iran-Contra scandal. Well, all of the drugs were coming in, and a man by the name of Kevin Dobson was the man who actually was helping centralize the cocaine that was coming in from Offutt Air Force Base in town. And I think you can still get them. I know it's on my website somewhere, but I have 35 pages, so I'd have to look through it. But I believe that if you type in Kevin Dobson and Dylan, they were basically the ones who brought down Pablo Escobar's nephew. And Kevin Dobson is the one who actually got Pablo Escobar basically executed.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Jill, did you have something? I had another question, but I was going to wait on you.
Oh, no. Look, if I did anything at the moment, my mind's in Westminster. So my mind's in Westminster cover-up and the pedophile scandals going on there. And something that I read recently, which was really quite bizarre, I've got it written down somewhere. I don't have the quote. It was from David Icke. And basically he was just saying that that heroin and child pedophile rings go fist in glove, for want of a better word. Would you like to comment on that? How much it's actually – like he reckons that Jimmy Savile and a guy called Terry somebody – actually is a massive drug dealer, and he ties it in with the Queen of England. He has a house right next to Buck House, and apparently they're all the same people doing the heroin and the child trafficking. Do you know anything about that, David?
Well, I actually am friends with someone who is by the name of Judy Byington. She wrote a book called 22 yep. Faces. 22 mm-hmm. Faces is something that the False Memory Foundation is struggling to battle against terribly. And she works with a man named Kevin Arnett.
And I know Kevin.
Kevin Arnett.
I know Kevin.
Yeah, he's basically asserting that they knew about it. You know, drugs and this child prostitution, satanic ritual abuse, and drug abuse go hand in hand. They do. They're fist in glove.
Yeah.
Because it basically keeps the children quiet. It keeps them down. It is easier to convince them that they don't know what's going on when they're drugged out and they don't know what reality is and what reality isn't. And so it's an easy way to actually commit crimes and not get busted for it.
It's probably easier to handle it too.
But this whole situation, you know, that's from what I understand, I have a lot of friends who are over in the UK and they are starting to they're starting to bust down on the reports that are being let out to the community because they're afraid that riots will happen when they all find out about the information. And so, and whatever happens in the UK generally happens in America eventually. It eventually comes over. Not always, but, you know, lot of times it happens at the UK first, and eventually it'll spill over to America.
It does. David, this network here, this network is based in Ireland, and it does. A lot of things get over here eventually.
He's saying the radio network is based in Ireland.
The radio network is.
Yeah.
Well, they just found in Ireland that, they just found a gravesite that has 500 children in it. Or at least 900 children.
And some of them were, their bodies were actually dismembered. I mean, like, you know, decapitated, and their bodies were not in one piece. So something had been done to some of these bodies before they were thrown or buried. Yeah, the buried ones, definitely, some of them had... examining the skeletons, they have been chopped up. And you said that you saw people being chopped up. I just want to bring the personal thing into it. I don't want it to be my aim, because you're just such a very rare person, David. And, you know, I've probably only got about another 10 or 15 minutes that I can try and extract this from you, is like you're a real live witness. And that's more important than any of the facts, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of what I'm digging at the moment. And you've actually, I've read it, but you're the first person, you know, that I've seen face to face on Skype that has actually witnessed that they do chop these children up. And I even read that the Ninth Satanic Circle, and bring it back to what you've seen, please, David, actually rape and then dismember very, 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 very tiny babies to become a pope.
No, I don't know about that. I've heard about breeders and destroying. And the interesting thing about it is that my oldest brother, who is also named David, lived 24 hours, and my parents never spoke about him, ever. He was the oldest firstborn son of my father. And personally, my father and I told my father one time that I believed that David was a sacrifice, that he was forced to sacrifice his firstborn son. And my dad wouldn't deny it. And so I took that as a, you know, admission of guilt, because otherwise he would have denied it.
Yep. So two questions then, to go one step back. What is the rationale to kill your first son? Like, what rationale could trick you into that?
There is a series of... When you look at cult behavior and you look at, and I mean, this is even when you look at gang behavior, you know, we'll take Hell's Angels for an example. Certain people, well, no, let's take this Satanist stuff, because that's probably easier. Some people were invited to parties, but they weren't invited to stay afterwards. Some people were invited to the parties, invited to stay after, but they weren't invited to Hummel Park. Some people were invited to the parties, they were invited to stay after, they were invited to Hummel Park, but they weren't invited to the orgies that were going on. So you had this step up of, you know, each time you committed something, or you made yourself, they just didn't let anybody come to Hommel Park. They just didn't let anybody, you know, the people who actually were there, the sacrifices, there was usually 12 men there. You know, there were women involved, but for the most part, it was a male-dominated type situation. And you had a cult member. A good example is Colonel Michael Aquino, who was my personal handler. He just has a book out now on Amazon called Extreme Prejudice, where he talks about himself and making himself out to be the victim of the Presidio daycare. He's not a victim of the Presidio daycare. And so I actually wrote a review on his book on Amazon and talked about how he went on to Oprah. And after he went on to Oprah, 800 people called in claiming that he had abused them, sexually abused them. And so you have this hierarchy. I mean,
I'll bet that didn't get out, did it? I'll bet that kind of news didn't get out very well, did it?
Well, he hasn't replied to anything, and they haven't taken down the review. So they also have the False Memory Foundation will go after 22 Faces and say that it's crazy, and yet they expounded a book called The Trauma Myth, which basically I just read and did an interview with and basically said, well, if you're a pedophile and you're looking for justification, this is the book for you. Because it basically said that most people who are sexually abused, it's a loving type situation and it's not abuse. It's not fear. There's not coercion.
These are all these NAMBLA people who want to have sex with children, and it's extraordinary.
NAMBLA, yeah.
Yeah, when you look back at the beginnings of the False Memory Foundation, people such as Ralph Underwager, who went on to the Paddock Review, who Paddock magazine, and said that sexual abuse between adults and children really needs to be let up on because it's actually a good thing and not a bad thing. The funding for the False Memory Foundation was being done by NAMBLA, the North American Man Boy Love Association. And so you have all of these connections to all of these people who, you know, it's just really disheartening. And you're finding it even more so in the UK with the Jimmy Savile case and it being linked all the way up to, you know, the royal family.
Well, that was one thing I wanted to mention, David. It seems that all of these prominent people, Jimmy Savile, Jerry Sandusky, I think I mentioned to you on the first show that local police knew about that way back in 1994. Some of those kids' parents reported on that, and they covered it up. The media covered it up. The FBI covered it up. ESPN even knew about it back then, and they covered it up. It just seems, I wanted to mention that there's a Lord McAlpine that just died. And, if you happen to know David Icke, he had been calling this Lord McAlpine a pedophile for 16 years, and he was never sued for it. Whenever I think I heard David talk about it one time, he said, whenever this Lord McAlpine was asked about David Icke's accusations, he would just laugh and say that David Icke was mad.
And laugh it off.
Yeah. Well, and they just seem to laugh it off.
Well, I even wonder why the Queen, you know, Prince Philip's mother was put in a sanatorium. She probably knew stuff.
Well, that's what they do. They get rid of the people. With Jerry Sandusky, all you have to do is look at the prosecuting attorney who was trying to investigate it, who disappeared with his hard drive from
six years earlier. Yeah.
Not his laptop, just the hard drive.
Just the hard drive, yeah.
You know, and so much like Gary Caridori in Omaha, Nebraska, who, you know, called and said he had specific proof, and then his plane got blown up. And Robert Wadman, who was one of the people he was investigating, was one of the first people on the scene.
David, go on.
Well, it's just the cover-up is absolutely amazing. And when you start to realize what has happened, you know, it's hard.
Look what the Pope and the Queen just did. They just made an agreement that they wouldn't, that they both, I haven't got the document with me, but they're both, the Pope came to England and the Queen went to Italy, and they signed a document saying that they'll both cover up stories.
Yeah, that's, That was what I had heard. That's what I'm getting from my friends over in the UK, is that they're saying that is if, because if the news of what they're trying to cover up, if it actually got out to the people, they're afraid of riots.
Well, the accusation of the Queen is of satanic, ritualistic killings and even cannibalism.
Well, they've just made, they've both made laws that you're not allowed to tell anything against the Vatican, or you'll be thrown in the Vatican.
Not allowed to tell anything against the Vatican or the Queen.
Yeah, and she's made similar laws. So, and they're actually trying to bring in laws within England at the moment that you can't divulge the truth.
Certainly. They,
well, you had, you know, in Omaha, Nebraska, you had Boys Town, which was the Catholic institution in America at the time, heavily involved with transporting boys down to the old market to be actually sexually abused. And so the Catholic Church has been heavily involved with all of this. And the Satanism actually stems and comes from the UK. It didn't start in America. It started from in the UK. You know, you had people like Aleister Crowley and all of that stuff. Yeah. You know,
in France.
It didn't start with Anton LaVey and Michael Aquino. They were just offsets of the people that were really Satanists who were actually taken off in UK.
Sure, they were protégés.
Yeah, they were protégés.
So you somehow broke away from being a protégé. And, you know, this is the point that that's sort of the part I'm really most interested in at the moment, David, is this sort of – I can preface it with telling you a story of when my father died, and he was on, well, it was some time before he died, but he thought he was on his deathbed, and he recovered, thank God, but at that time, but he's dead now. But anyway, so he was telling me about all the things that he and people that he'd killed, and I said, "Forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do," because he was going, why did we do it? And I just grabbed a phrase that would suit him, which is, "Forgive them, Father, for, you know," I said, "you were young, you didn't know what you were doing." And so in terms of you breaking away from your incredible normality and indoctrination, what happened at that aha moment you had when you burnt that guy when you were 12? How did you break away? What happened after that? How long did you stay away for? I mean, 12 is very young. Like, what did you do? Where did you find refuge?
Well, we actually went on the run right after that, after we lit him on fire. My father took a job in Grettinger, Iowa, which is a basically northern part of the Iowa, where a town of 900 people. So we hid in Grettinger. And right after that, I ended up trying to kill myself and was
why,
put.
Why? What were you thinking when you tried to kill yourself?
You know, I believed I was the Antichrist. I was taught that I was the Antichrist. I was going to be the Antichrist. And so I was trying to kill myself to actually keep myself from being the Antichrist. It was something I never wanted.
Yeah.
And so I ended up trying to kill myself. And then I had social workers who had been involved because my sister, Kathy, got social workers involved in my father's house because of the abuse that was going on. And so because after we killed the guy, after I was forced to light him on fire, my abuse, I mean, escalated to the point where it was terrible. I mean, I was just being, I was wishing I was dead every day. Oh, and so I got sent to a state hospital where I stayed there for 5 months. And that was an actual turning point in my life.
You were sent to a state hospital, probably fairly beaten up when you got there, or was it psychiatric or what?
Well, my father, the social workers took me to the hospital, and the first thing my father said to me when he got me alone in the hospital was, "We had a train that ran right out in front of our house. Why didn't I just jump in front of the train?" Mm. And the hospital thought that my parents were not good for me, so they kept me away from my parents for 5 months. And in that 5 months, I was not emotionally or physically or sexually hurt in any way. And so I started to realize that there was another way around life. And I also had people who were involved who had high amounts of faith. And so it was about that time that I started reading the Bible. And I mean, not to be trite or anything like that, but the scriptures actually did help me get through a lot of what I went through. And then the other thing that helped me is that I eventually grew physically much bigger than my father and my stepmother. And so being a little boy and being abused is completely different than being a 6'3" guy And they think twice. My dad was only, 5'9", 5'10", and my stepmother was about the same size. So them thinking about hitting me or doing anything like that. So a lot of it was just the emotional abuse. And I spent a lot of time, even as a young adult, trying to figure out how not to be the Antichrist. In fact, my book, when I started writing it at the beginning, it was called Confessions of an Antichrist. Right. I changed the and so I basically.
So when did you realize you weren't the Antichrist?
I was 28 years old, and I talked to a friend of mine and told her that I was afraid I was going to be the Antichrist. And she looked at me and said, you're going to be the Antichrist. She said, what are you going to do? Insult people's clothing choices?
David, somebody
she
else
told had- me, the minute I started to make somebody feel bad, I would feel bad myself.
Yeah.
And that I wouldn't make much of an Antichrist. And that was when I started to realize, you're right. I wouldn't make much of an Antichrist.
there's another question from the chat, Antichrist. David.
But it took me, it took me a lot of years to actually get away from that.
There's another question from the chat, David. How do you know the Satanism started in the UK?
Just basically because of the history of the whole situation. Obviously the UK is a lot more, the UK is a lot older and has a lot more history than America. And from what a lot of this stems from, a lot of this stems from at the very beginning, which is from Greek readings, that there was a group of people who believed that the serpent in the Garden of Eden was actually the champion of mankind and the champion of free choice. There is another side that has always been around. It hasn't always been that God, was the savior and Jesus Christ came down. They actually believed that the serpent actually, that God was a tyrant and was distant. And the person who actually to be worshiped is the serpent, which is Satan. And so, it doesn't even start in the UK. It starts in the Middle East. These are Gnostic principles that they had. And so, this is ancient. This is centuries long.
It is.
It's not, and the families that were involved, like my family was generational. My father was inducting me. My Uncle Phil inducted my dad. I don't know who inducted my Uncle Phil.
But, what were they looking for? Like, what did they think was going to be the fruit of Satanism that was so superior to any other method, psychological or spiritual or religious method in life?
It's a spiritual power they get from the children, I think. Isn't it, David?
Well, it stems from the children. And basically what ends it, well, in America, there's a division in America. First, you had Anton LaVey, who had Church of Satan, who basically was designed to actually make fun of Christianity. It was meant to mock Christianity. Aquino was involved with the Temple of Satan, or the Church of Satan, until he broke away in 74 and set up Temple of Set. The difference between Church of Satan and Temple of Set is that Church of Satan was satanic and Temple of Set is Luciferian. The difference is that they believe in the Antichrist. They believe in Lucifer. They believe in an Antichrist that's going to actually come override heaven, and all of the people who follow the Antichrist will be given riches. And, again, they don't adhere to the scriptures of, the whole thing about heaven wins and Satan is cast down. That's not the way they think at all. They think it's up for grabs still. And, the children are, a lot of what they're focusing on is that children were God's favorite. It's written over and over and over that children are God's favorite. They're the closest to God. And so basically what they're doing is trying to mock God and send children back through as much pain as they possibly can. And that's what I basically personally believe.
Jill? Oh, well.
Yes. Yes, I'm here.
I was going to say, do you have a follow-up or do you have a last question?
Yeah.
Or are they going to be the same?
We'll just make the last one. What I'm trying to work out is, why do you think that the establishment in England and the establishment in Italy, i.e. the royal family, the houses of lords and ladies, and the Vatican and the Church of England and also the Archbishop of Canterbury, why do you think they'd be interested in Satanism? Like, how
I'm not so sure that they're involved with Satanism, or they're, you know, that everyone believes in Satanism.
Just what, certain families.
Satanism goes hand in hand with child exploitation and trafficking. And so basically what I would say is that most people who are involved with Satanism, at least in Omaha, Nebraska, were involved with the parties and they were involved with the money. Because you get a child, I mean, just look at it as far, look at a child as far as the money that comes in. You can abduct a child 3 days after beating and raping that child. That child will do just basically anything you want them to do because of the Stockholm syndrome. Then you can sell that child over and over and over and over, make untold amount of money until that child is no longer useful, then or pliable. Then you get rid of the child. You do a snuff film. A snuff film back in the 60s and 70s were, I believe, $50,000 to $60,000 for one film. And then after you have the snuff film, then you harvest the organs and you actually sell the organs on the black market.
$50,000 each for an organ, yeah.
Exactly.
But the organs have to be still going boom, 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 boom.
But Jill, you also this.
That means you'd need doctors, Jill, with cryovac,
yes,
stuff,
yes,
there. What?
Jill, this is the same type of a ring that will take a dark-haired, blue-eyed girl and sell for $500,000 to somebody. This is the same type of a group. But we're at the hour here. I know we could just go on and on and on. Maybe we could have another show, Jill, with David.
Yeah, that'd be lovely. Thank you very much.
Jill, it has been a pleasure. I would love to reach me anytime. I would answer any of your questions. You've been a pleasure to actually. Stephen, you were always... You're always wonderful, but Jill, it's been remarkable, actually. I like your questions.
Yeah. Thank you.
I don't say that just arbitrarily. It's just, you know.
Well, they are psychoanalytic in nature, aren't they, Jill?
They're curious.
Okay. Well, once again, thank you for coming on, David Churcher. I will throw both of your links in there, the Amazon book link and your website book link, into the chat room once again.
Yeah, thanks, David, and thank you for offering yourself to my sacrificial altar. I will definitely take you up on that offer.
Thank you. Thank you. Get some really hard questions and just, you know, bring them on. Yeah. Bring them on. So,
all right.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll be in touch. Thank you, Stephen Roberts, the magnificent.
Thank you, Jill, and thank you, David, once again.
Hey, thank you so much, and have a great evening, guys.
Yes, you too. And thank you, everyone, for sticking around in the chat room there on People's Internet Radio. So I will see everyone Wednesday night once again. I'm Stephen Roberts, and this is Cancel a Cabal. Oh, let me get something ready here. All right. Good night, everyone.